Next case is United States v. Voorhees. Is the appellant ready to argue? The government? Appellant may argue.
Good morning. May it please the court, Chief Judge Suki, members of the court. Your Honor, may I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please?
Yes.
Thank you. Your Honors, I don't leave my family in Houston and come all the way here to Washington, D.C. to sell you a story. I'm not in the business of representing guilty people. This man is innocent. I say that obviously for illustration purposes only, but if it sounds familiar, it's because it's the flip side of what the prosecutor said to the members in this case.
The counsel, in fairness, wasn't that in those particular statements in rebuttal after the appellant's counsel had essentially said that the trial counsel would come there to make up a big story and fill them with emotion, et cetera, et cetera?
Your Honor, it was in response, but my answer to that is the trial counsel is entitled to respond, but he must do it appropriately and legally and not violate this court's holdings going back as far as Fletcher at a minimum. So if he wanted to respond, he could respond, but he didn't do it appropriately, and that's why error occurred in this case. You may be thinking, here we go again, another improper argument case. We've been hearing
I was
going
to say
that. Sorry, sir?
I was going to say just that.
Well, my mission today, Your Honors, is to convince you that this case is different. This case is different than Andrews and Sewell, Pavlona, and Hornback, and this case warrants reversal.
Now, let me ask you this, Ms. Zimmerman. If it is as bad as you say it is, what was defense counsel doing? They were sitting there letting the trial counsel go on and on about this? Hurl ad hominem attacks, even at him or her. I don't know if at the trial whether it was a he or a she, but the defense counsel, you see my point.
I absolutely see your point. And
there is no
lawyer, it drives me insane.
I'm not being driven insane by it, but the other problem is there's no claim that this counsel was ineffective. So basically, we might even assume that they wanted this trial counsel to make a spectacle of himself. What about that?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I think that's speculation that goes a bit too far to presume that he.
But what would be the reason why the defense counsel is sitting there like a bump on a log?
Well, I was going to use the bump on a log.
I beat you to it because I already used it.
Certainly did. In my view, there's no good professional reason, but I will tell you, having been doing this as long as I have, I don't believe in this. But
you would never mistake because you've been doing this a long time.
Exactly. You should believe me when I say no. Some lawyers believe that it is rude to object to opposing counsel's argument, and they also feel like it may focus the jury or the members on that specific objectionable comment. And you can see throughout the record here that this defense counsel. I think it's a fair inference from the record because this defense counsel does make other objections throughout the course of the trial. He does not make any objections during argument. And even when the military judge gives her improper sua sponte instruction at the conclusion of his argument, he still doesn't object in front of the members. He asks for a 39A.
Well, couldn't he have done that with respect to the argument? Either after or during the argument? Sir, can I have a 39A session? We need to talk about something. Let the members walk out. I'd like to lodge an objection here against the trial counsel for this indecorous language that he or she is using. And at that point, you could say, I didn't want to jump up in front of the members and bring attention to this, but I'm doing it now. Why couldn't the defense counsel have done that with respect to the argument?
I wish he had. He could have and he should have. But that does not relieve the government, the trial counsel, his obligation to make a proper argument. And it doesn't relieve the trial judge from maintaining order in the court.
Now, I agree with that. But don't we have some cases where we've inserted this language about dicta, albeit, that how prejudicial could it have been if the defense counsel lodged no objection to it? Don't we have some cases that suggest that?
Yes, Your Honor. And my answer to that, respectfully, is that's one factor for the court to consider when determining how severe the conduct is,
mm-hmm.
but it's not the only factor.
Okay.
Comments for you. When he said, I'm not in the business of convicting innocent people, but this man is guilty, he was talking about the Article 120 offense, correct? The one that is now off. Well, in context, he was talking about the Article 120 offense, and that is off the table, correct?
Well, the 120 is somewhat off the table, Your Honor, but first...
But was this approved by the CCA, so in that sense, it's off the table?
Yes, Your Honor, but the harm from those arguments spilled over to the 133s, and I'm not sure we can take it in such isolation because the defense counsel had argued, albeit not for as forcefully as I would have liked, that Major Voorhees was not guilty of the 133s because the conduct didn't rise to the level of being unbecoming. And so
but most of the argument was about the Article 120, right? He even said the real reason we're here is about the Article 120 offense.
That's right, because I think it's fair to say that but for the 120, these 133s would have never seen the inside of a courtroom.
Okay, and so now let's talk about the Article 133 offenses. So, and this is, I think, a fair question, which is, given the standard for Article 133 offenses, how can one politely characterize the behavior of an officer and still meet the burden? You know what I'm saying? How can they meet the standard that the military judges can instruct the members on without characterizing the behavior as in colorful language?
In the argument, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm.
Very easily. What the trial counsel should have focused on is commenting on the evidence and as it pertained to the actions and not the person. And you can look at the plain language of the trial counsel's statement. He said, this is the nature of this man. He's not talking about the nature of the offense or the nature of the acts committed. He said, the nature of this man. He's sick. He's perverted. He's a joke of an officer. He's a narcissistic pig. Those are personal attacks. And that's not his job, is to personally attack. And what he did was he convinced the members, backed up by the trial judge, frankly, that Major Voorhees was a terrible person and had a lying, not worthy of belief lawyer, and it worked. It convinced the members to convict, and that's what the harm is here. They convicted him on the argument and not on the evidence alone.
What was the rank of the trial counsel? Do you remember?
I know very well. He's a captain. He's a special victim qualified prosecutor.
All right. I don't know what all that means, but... the rank, as I recall, the makeup of the members in this case were lieutenant colonels and colonels, wasn't it?
They were senior because Major Voorhees obviously was senior.
Right. Well, I guess I'm wondering, are colonels and lieutenant colonels individuals who are probably best situated in determining the quality and character of a fellow officer's conduct? Are they really going to be convinced by some captain sitting there shouting about the accused and his lawyer and all of that? Do you really think that that's the case?
In this case, yes, Your Honor, because the comments were so repetitive, so egregious, and again, I told you I was going to give you two reasons why this case is different. The first reason is because of the action of the military judge. She didn't just sit there silently and not interject as she should have, which would have been an implicit approval of his comments. She affirmatively told the members, the defense counsel doesn't know what he's doing. And by doing that, she told the members, if I know I can tell you if the trial lawyers make a mistake, and I'm not telling you anything that, I'm not telling you that the trial counsel made a mistake, I'm only telling you the defense lawyer made a mistake. And so because the trial judge took sides, she abandoned her neutral.
That issue isn't before us, counsel.
I'm sorry?
That issue isn't before us, is it?
It is, because it goes to the harm. But just because what Judge Sparks is saying is that in a normal case where the judge just sits silently and doesn't interject and take sides for either side, maybe the lieutenant colonels could fact and go, he's just blowing smoke.
No, my point was that in this kind of case specifically, a 133 offense, where you have senior officers sitting determining whether or not the conduct alleged against the accused is unbecoming conduct for an officer. They are uniquely situated, are they not, in making that kind of a determination, as opposed to kind of a regular offense with anybody else. Would you not agree with that?
I would agree with you, Judge Sparks, but I just can't, I don't think that the severity of these comments can be overstated.
Okay, but do you disagree that an Article 133 offense, that, because you said no, they could just talk about the conduct but not about the person, but isn't the heart of an Article 133 offense, you know, how the conduct impacts the status of the person?
Of the recipient?
No, of the person, well, of the officer. So, for example, what an E3 or an E4 could do would be totally permissible because they're not an officer and a gentleman. But the whole question about Article 133 offenses is, how did it impact this person standing as an officer, either in an official capacity or an unofficial capacity? Here, it was official because all of the people were his subordinates. So all I'm saying is comments that certainly would be clearly inappropriate in a different kind of case. I'm not so sure that the line isn't a little bit different in an Article 133 offense.
I'm not sure. I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that it would have been a fair argument for the trial counsel to get up and tell the members, look at these statements he made. Look at these text messages he sent. That is not what we expect of our officers. That was disgraceful, dishonorable, and unbecoming. You should find him guilty. That would have been perfectly appropriate.
So they can't say it was deplorable. They can't say it was absolutely dishonoring. They can't say it was disgusting.
The first ones are okay. The disgusting is a little more borderline. But in all candor, those aren't the comments that I think are most egregious. The most egregious ones are that I don't leave my family 250 days a year to go TDY to prosecute innocent people or to sell you a story, and I'm not in the business of convicting innocent people. He's guilty.
Even in the context of responding to a defense counsel argument where they clearly said that that's exactly what the trial counsel was doing in
no,
so
Your
many
Honor.
Words?
My mother, I don't mean to be flip, but my mother always told me two wrongs don't make a right.
So, counsel, though, isn't the most egregious comments that were made by the trial counsel was calling this accused, who had not been convicted yet, a pig?
Absolutely.
He called him a joke of an officer. So what flows from that is the question, going back to the very beginning of this oral argument, that Judge Sparks posed, why wouldn't a defense counsel object to an accused being called a pig and a joke of an officer? And my question then is, doesn't the record tell us, wasn't there tactical acquiescence on the part of defense counsel here? He sat there mute, and then when it came time to for his argument, the defense counsel was essentially saying to these very senior panel members, this trial counsel is acting as if he's frothing at the mouth. He's a rabid person here. And the defense counselor is saying that you learn in law school to pound the table and to shout when the facts aren't in favor of you, talks about the theatrics and so forth. So a concern I have is appellant trying to get two bites of the apple? At the trial level, defense counsel sits back, uses these clearly outrageous comments through tactical acquiescence, trying to get the senior panel to say, rule against the theatrics of the prosecutor. But then you come up to us at the appellate level and say, this was prosecutorial misconduct, but it wasn't objected to by the defense counsel.
So you've answered the question why Judge Sparks said, why is an ineffective assistance of counsel? Because arguably there's a tactical reason. I personally don't. I think tactical and strategic decisions have to be based on reasonable strategy. It can't be just any strategy, and I don't think it was reasonable here. But so there can be a multitude of explanations for that, and perhaps another explanation, Your Honor, would be, what if he has this policy? I'm not going to object during argument, but I look at how he's doing. I'm going to respond to that and tell the members he's just frothing at the mouth. In other words, it may have been a reaction to the argument, not planned.
But then why don't we have a problem with two bites of the apple?
I didn't represent Major Voorhees at the trial, and Major Voorhees should not be held. I mean, he's the one who suffered. I mean, if the trial lawyer
it's
had
not an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. It's a prosecutorial misconduct claim.
So the prosecutor shouldn't have said these things, and the judge shouldn't have let him, and the judge shouldn't have given the message to the jury, to the members, that this was okay. And so because all, as Judge Sparks has said in Andrews, all of the lawyers in the room are responsible for the fair trial. Poor Major Voorhees is the only non-lawyer in the room. He has no control over this. Why should he suffer because none of the lawyers in the room did their job, including the defense counsel?
Before we run out of time, I'd like to follow up a little bit on what Judge Ryan asked you before. Several of the inappropriate comments related directly to the Article 120 offense, not specifically to the 133 offense. And your response was, well, there was still a problem because of spillover. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? How do we assess the spillover?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The trial counsel's mission, which he accomplished, was to convince the members that Major Voorhees was just a despicable human being who had a lying lawyer. And therefore, when the judge especially agreed with him, that they got the message they should not believe anything the defense counsel said. So remember what I said about the 133 defense. Trial defense counsel, especially, and we haven't even talked about the mens rea, without the instruction telling the members that they had to find that he was at least reckless with regard to whether the conduct was unbecoming, all the members were left with was this lawyer that the judge doesn't think very much of and the trial counsel doesn't think very much of has told us that this conduct does not rise to the level of a criminal offense, but we're not going to listen to what he has to say. The military, he had no instruction to refer to back up that argument. And so by convincing the members that they should not like Major Voorhees or think he has any worth whatsoever to the Air Force, it not only went to the 120, but also the 133. That's the spillover I'm discussing. See that my time is up?
I just asked the Chief Judge for permission to ask you a question here. Could you please address the question of the strength of the evidence in light of the fact that there were electronic communications, there were admissions by counsel about hitting on a lot of women and so forth? Could you please address that?
Judge Olson, that is the third factor of Fletcher, and that's the second reason why this case is different. This court has been holding that the evidence is overwhelming, and therefore, no matter what the prosecutor says, if the evidence is overwhelming, it's not harmful error. And it is harmful in this case, and here's why. When you assess the weight of the evidence, the court has to determine what the elements are, just like the court did in Andrews. And in doing that, the court has to apply Alonis and Haverty and Gifford. And the element of mens rea was completely lacking. It was lacking from the charge sheet to the instructions to the argument. So the evidence may have been strong on the first element. Pre-Alonis, Article 33 only had two elements, right? That the accused did something or failed to do something, and two, that it was objectively unbecoming. Now we have a third element, I believe, is fair to argue, under Alonis, And so when evaluating the weight of the evidence, yeah, there was evidence that he committed these acts. I think the evidence is much weaker that the acts rose to the level of unbecoming. And there's no evidence on his mens rea. The only evidence in the text messages themselves is, I might get in some administrative trouble for this. I'm doing something I'm not supposed to be doing, and I'm going to get fired from the. That's why we have counseling and NJP and BOIs.
Counsel, on rebuttal, if you would please address why it is that you believe that Alonis changed Article 133 into some sort of an objective, specific intent as opposed to a general intent offense, I'd appreciate
it. And also, please address why at least Issue 2 is waived under RCM 907.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Ann Del Mar. I'm here today with Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, and we represent the United States in this matter. This court should affirm the lower court's decision and not disturb the findings and sentence in this case. I'd like to first begin by addressing Issues 2 and 3. The Article 133 offenses in this case were legally sufficient. They contain all elements of the offense. They inform appellant of the acts against which he must defend. They're sufficient to prevent future prosecutions. And in the context of Article 133, general intent sufficiently separates wrongful from otherwise innocent conduct in accordance with Fosler and the test set out in Alonis. So in order to be found guilty under Article 133, appellant must have had the general intent to commit the act, and that under the circumstances, it was conduct unbecoming of an officer.
And is that second part of the test judged by an objective or a subjective standard?
Judge Ryan, that is by an objective standard. I believe this court's precedent is that it's a reasonable officer should have known. So it is that second element that separates this conduct. I believe that this court's precedent in Caldwell and Reaper also are instructive on this matter. In Caldwell, this court noticed the long history since Parker v. Levy addressing that the military must insist upon respect and discipline without counterpart to civilian life, and has identified and acknowledged that the military environment is different with a unique need to preserve good order and discipline. Also in Caldwell, this court acknowledged that general intent can be sufficient in this military-specific offense to distinguish between innocent and wrongful conduct. In Raypert, this court also considered an offense under Article 133 and determined that the term wrongful within the offense was sufficient to separate wrongful from innocent conduct. Similarly, here we have that second element, which requires that the conduct be unbecoming of an officer and gentleman. So specifically that it must be dishonoring and disgracing. And that language is sufficient to distinguish between wrongful and innocent conduct. Even if this court were to disagree that
I think you're about to move on, so I want to just hit upon a point before you do so, please, counsel. So do you think that Caldwell sets a very good pattern for how to address this issue? And essentially, just as in with Caldwell, we're essentially, from your position, we would say that if objectively there is conduct on becoming an officer, that in no way would that conduct be lawful. And therefore, we really don't run into an aloneness problem.
Yes, Judge Olson, that is the government's position, that any conduct that is on becoming an officer can in no way be innocent conduct. If this court were to disagree, it's the government's position that the appellant was not prejudiced in this case. First, the appellant was put on notice. So this court in Humphrey said that if there was to be a defect in the specification, it would need to result in material prejudice to the appellant's substantial right to notice. Here it seems pretty evident that the appellant was on notice that his conduct was unbecoming of an officer. It's not just that it may have, but that he actually understood that. And you can see that in the evidence of each specification where he's prefacing his conduct with telling the individuals that this could end his career. He's asking them to delete those text messages, and he's apologizing afterwards for that misconduct.
So based on the government's position that general intent is adequate, did the military judge adequately instruct the panel based on what was actually told them?
And it's the government's position that it did, and again, that Caldwell is instructive on this matter, and that the military judge made clear that the members were to consider the conduct under the circumstances. These instructions can reasonably be understood to requiring the panel members to determine whether appellant knew he was engaging in that misconduct.
Could you address defense appellant's counsel's points in regard to the strength of the government's evidence? That, of course, is key in any of these cases. Could you please address it from the government's perspective?
Yes, Judge Olson. So it's the government's position that the evidence in this case was overwhelming. Not only was there witness testimony on each allegation, that there was text messages, that actually a lot of the language that was charged was encompassed in those text messages that corroborated that. There's pretext phone call and messages after the pretext phone call that also corroborated that testimony. And the defense counsel essentially conceded that the conduct in this case is not what was in question.
Now, do we as a court need to tease out the evidence that had to do with the offense of which he was acquitted in terms of looking at the overall issue here?
And the government's position on that is that, yes, that it would be the evidence that went to the 120 is moot at this point. And so, again, that just that weighs in favor of the government.
What about the appellant's argument that there was a spillover in terms of the improper argument related to the Article 120 offenses? It spilled over to the Article 133 offenses?
Well, I think that those were two separate offenses, Judge Ryan, and I could see
she said basically that the tone or the tenor and tone and thrust of the entire argument was this is a worthless person and his defense counsel is a liar.
And I think that language was separate. That was the trial counsel specifically addressing the 133 offenses, the conversations that appellant was having with these individuals, the conversations he was having to solicit these relationships with these three women. And so I believe the language where he's talking about this appellant being deplorable, being despicable.
What about the lying, the comment about the defense counsel lying?
So, and I'll turn to those comments. So the government's view is that there's really three categories of comments made by the trial counsel. There's those that are improper. It was improper for trial counsel to have said that he leaves his family 250 days a year and bring evidence that was not at trial, commenting on evidence that was not at trial.
Counsel, I can't hear you.
Yes, Chief Judge. So it is our position that it was improper for the trial counsel to have commented on evidence that was not admitted into evidence at trial. So that would be the 250 days a year comment. It was certainly inartful and inappropriate for trial counsel to comment on misplaced lying, although both of those comments were made in the context of...
Comment on what? I'm really having trouble here. Not hearing, but understanding you. What was inartful as opposed to improper?
It would be improper for the trial counsel to have
comment on
evidence,
matters not in evidence.
Not in evidence.
Right.
And
what was inartful? I love that word.
It was inartful, and I Chief Judge, being frank, inappropriate for counsel to have called the defense counsel's misinterpretation or misrepresentation of the record to be lying. That seems to go so far as to comment.
Attacking one's fellow officer, one's fellow judge advocate, in a court, in open court, to this judge at least seems a little more than inartful. In the first place, it seems very artful. It clearly was planned. I doubt that he did it as a matter of, just popping off. I think he did it for a reason. And how is that ever permissible? And what on earth was the trial judge doing?
And Chief Judge, the government agrees with you that is improper, that was error. The government's position is...
The government's brief is very interesting. The government really goes like the Israelites in Egypt to try and build this pyramid that, this is horrible, but it's really not so bad. I've got to hand it to whoever wrote that brief that you really put in the effort. But
can I say I don't hand it to the government in any way, shape, or form. To call an accused who is sitting there being tried, he hasn't even been convicted, a pig, is completely outrageous. And in your brief, I mean, I think it's clear from the way this has progressed, you've got an issue when it comes to strength of the case and so forth. But in your brief, you don't just try to minimize that comment, you embrace and endorse it. On page 19 of your brief, you say the trial counsel's comments were, quote, a reasonable inference from the evidence admitted at trial and not outside the norms of fair comment. Calling an accused service member a pig is not outside the norms? Are you distancing yourself from that representation here this morning?
No, Judge Olson. So
you do feel that we should bless, as a court, we should say it's perfectly fine for a trial counsel to call an accused in open court before panel members, a joke of an officer, and a pig. Now, I note that he didn't say the comments that were made, the text messages that were relayed, were piggish. He called that service member sitting there a pig. And you want us to say that's perfectly fine.
Well, and Judge Olson, I would agree that it was improper. In context, the trial counsel was saying this appellant, his conduct was boorish. He's sitting there.
You just said the correct thing. His conduct was boorish. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about calling a service member a pig.
And Judge Olson, I believe in the heat of advocacy, that trial counsel poorly worded, I think it would have been...
That was in the heat of trial advocacy. Doesn't excuse it. But sitting in appellate government quarters, writing that it is, quote, not outside the norms of fair comment, that has me gravely concerned.
Counsel's counsel started this like another improper argument case, right? And the thing that we struggle with is that the law is the law, and we're going to apply the law regardless of the behavior, like if the rest of the test comes out the other way. But it is not helpful at all to have the government in a brief say that it's okay to call a person a pig. Like, I understand it's an Article 133 offense and that there's some comments which they claim are inappropriate that I would struggle with agreeing with that. But calling someone a pig as opposed to calling behavior piggish, there is a difference.
And I agree, Judge Wright.
Attacking the defense counsel in open court.
So it's not helpful. It's not helpful to, A, have the conduct continue to persist at the trial level, and, B, to have the government try and somehow excuse it at the appellate level. Do you understand?
Yes, Judge Ryan, I do understand. And I think that the court and doctor was somewhat instructional on this, where they said when you're looking at the 133, or in doctor, it was lying. And the government counsel called the appellant a liar 21 times. And the court said you really have to look at it in the context of what the charge is. What is the trial counsel having to forcefully argue is that issue here? And what was that issue here was the appellant's conduct was inappropriate. And I agree with this court that it was, this is not language that the government condones that we think is, we want our trial counsel saying.
Well, then, counsel, Your brief is a puzzlement, and I'm not accusing you. I don't know who wrote the brief, but the government's brief really is astonishing in the way it treats this issue. So I'll be quiet.
And I'm just going to opine that the appellate government division has some responsibility to educate the trial counsel as to the lines that may or may not be crossed in this area. And it does not appear that that has happened at all.
Understood, John Dryan. And that is the government's position, that there are comments that were made at this trial that were inappropriate, that were improper, that were error. There were comments that within context were not error. And then there were comments that were simply not inappropriate at all, such as the trial counsel pointing out that the members needed to pay great attention to detail, and comments such as those. But recognizing that there were improper comments in this case, it's the government's position that these comments did not prejudice the appellant in this case. Specifically, there's a few factors that we'd ask the court to consider. First, that in that courtroom, the trial counsel's comments did not even provoke an objection from the defense, which this court in Halpin noted the absence of defense objection is some persuasive measure of the minimal impact on trial counsel's remarks. And I believe that this court can be convinced that this appellant was convicted on the merits of the case. The members acquitted this appellant, and I think that acquittal of one of the Article 133 offenses. And I believe that acquittal shows that the members weighed the evidence independently and assessed appellant's guilt without regard to counsel's comments. And then as we discussed, it's the government's position that in this case, there is very strong, overwhelming evidence of the appellant's guilt, aside from any proper comments made by trial counsel, and that this court needs to take into consideration that many of those comments went to a 120 offense that is no longer at issue here. But it's
how do you balance this? You've got egregious misconduct at trial. You have evidence that may indicate guilt. What are we supposed to do? Are we just supposed to say, well, gosh, this was really terrible, but you lose because there's evidence. What are we supposed to do?
I guess, Chief Judge, and I understand the court's concern here. However, Article 59 and this case precedents requires that there be a substantial right of the appellant was materially affected.
Did the appellant not have a substantial right to not be called a pig in open court?
Agreed, Chief Judge, and as improper as that may be, I believe that the weight of the evidence in this case, the government's position, is that the weight of the evidence in this case is overwhelming, and thus this court cannot find that it was it meets the burden to overturn.
Can we consider in determining whether we think that these the scattered improper comments had an impact, that he was convicted on that versus everything else, the composition of the panel?
I believe that's a relevant consideration, Judge Ryan, of how these members, and I think
did you say relevant or irrelevant?
A relevant consideration.
Relevant or irrelevant?
Relevant. consideration in this case. And again, I believe that goes to the fact that the members looked at the evidence and acquitted the appellant on at least one of the charges under Article 133. If this court has no further questions.
Since you have a minute and 55, can I just ask something a little bit off the beaten path here? Charge one, specification one, it reads, in regard to the location, it says, within the planet Earth. Is that a thing in the Air Force, within the planet Earth?
I have seen that, Judge Olson, that occasionally it's charged broadly.
Is that because they were on an aircraft? Is that possibly the reason?
That would be over the
planet. Not sure, Judge Sparks.
I mean, I was going to 7th grade science with the mantle and the core and the inner core when you say within the planet Earth. I'm just hoping we don't see that issue come before us in some of you.
Understood. This court should find the argument by trial counsel did not prejudice the substantial right of the appellant. Similarly, this court should find conduct unbecoming of an officer sufficiently states words of criminality under Article 133, and the military judge properly instructed the members on all elements of the offense. Even if this court finds otherwise, the appellant was not prejudiced, as the evidence was so overwhelming that this court can be confident that appellant was convicted on the evidence alone. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
I don't have much time. There's a lot to say. If I may take them in reverse order. So I feel compelled to point out that the government keeps referring to the pretext call and the comment that should I be preparing for confinement. I have to point out to the court that has nothing to do with the 133 charges. That has solely a response to the allegation the complaining witness made during that call. She alleged he sexually assaulted her. And that's what he was talking about, going to confinement. There's no indication that he thought he was doing anything criminal via the text messages at issue on the 133s. And the question is, if the evidence is so overwhelming, why did trial counsel have to resort to this kind of tactic? Obviously, he didn't think the evidence was overwhelming. And with regard to the mixed findings, all of the cases where this court has analyzed mixed findings, we've seen like 50% of the findings were acquittals. I can't remember, I don't have time to go through each case individually, but this case, one speck of all of them, and that was the speck where all of the witnesses agreed they participated in the same conduct. But remember what he was convicted of. He was convicted of sexually assaulting a woman who admitted on the stand that she never said or did anything to indicate a lack of consent, that all she did was say no in her head. And because the trial counsel and the judge convinced these members that Mr. Voorhees was such a bad guy, they convicted him of basically everything. So I don't think the mixed findings help in this case. And then with regard to your Honor's concern about training and trial counsel and are the trial lawyers reading the cases, it's really important to point out that this specific prosecutor who was at trial and made all these improper comments was also the trial counsel at the sentence rehearing. And what he said on page 360 of the joint appendix is, in closing, before the judge alone, he says, Your Honor has the evidence, and I don't mean to spend any more time than is necessary, but to give Your Honor my personal thoughts, because that's what this opportunity presents. He still didn't get the message, even after all the litigation at the lower court about how improper it was for him to offer his personal opinion. So he's not getting the message. And I think it's important to note that with regard to substantial right, he has a right not to be called a pig.
But I've got to ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
Where in our case law does it say, in these types of cases, whether it's prosecutorial misconduct or something similar, where it's our role as a court to send a message? Doesn't our precedent say, consistently, that what we have to look at is, yes, the misconduct, but we also have to look at the strength of the evidence. And there's nothing in there that says that we are empowered to decide a case based on our personal pique about the outrageous conduct of a prosecutor or our desire to send a message. aren't we limited by our precedent?
The answer is yes, but that doesn't solve the, that doesn't answer the question, because the answer is the court should find prejudice in this case. It's egregious. It's severe. It's repeated. There were no curative measures. The military judge not only didn't cure the error, she exacerbated and magnified it, and the evidence was not that strong. The evidence was only strong that he committed these acts and he thought he might have been violating some administrative regulation and he might get fired from the Air Force. There was no evidence of his mens rea.
Do you agree or disagree that the test is an objective test?
On the whether the conduct was unbecoming or not? Yes, Your Honor, I do. So may I answer your question about Alonis? Is that where you were going?
Sure.
So Alonis is on all fours here. Other than the offenses are different, but here's what Alonis, there's five things from Alonis that apply to this case. First, there was no dispute in Alonis that he knew the words he communicated. Two, the defendant must know the character of what was sent, not simply its contents and context. Three, the jury was instructed the government need prove only that a reasonable person would regard Alonis' communications as threats, and that was error.
Okay, but in Alonis, that was communicating a threat. Why isn't this really a Caldwell case?
This case is much more like Alonis than Caldwell, and here's why. This court has said so. This court held in Norville 20 years ago that the same conduct under some circumstances might be unbecoming and in different circumstances might not, and that's why the mens rea is important, because to distinguish wrongful conduct from innocent conduct. So in Caldwell, this court found that that conduct could never be innocent. In Norville, this court held that sometimes it could be innocent and sometimes it
could not. Doesn't that go back to my question about whether it's an objective test or a subjective test? So if it's an objective test, right, it doesn't matter whether he thought it was okay under the circumstances or whether he says he thought it was okay or whether he didn't think about it at all. What matters is what a reasonable officer would think.
But, Your Honor, that's a negligence standard, and the Supreme Court said in Alonis that's not enough.
Court never said that there couldn't be a general intent offense, particularly in a peculiarly military offense paradigm.
True, but this Court's opinions in both Haverty and Raypert are instructive. For example, in Raypert, it said, this aspect of intent relates to whether the speaker intended his or her words to be understood as sincere. That's important. It means that what's in the accused mind is relevant. And in the hazing, you said it's relevant, the context. And so I note that the government didn't reply to this argument at all in their 60 pages of brief.
Well, counsel, if I could, let's set aside for a minute the Alonis issue, the Caldwell issue, mens rea issue. Let's say, just for the sake of argument, I'm not asking you, of course, to concede on this point, but let's assume for a moment that this court were to decide that there isn't an Alonis problem. So we're just looking at the evidence. Why, when we've got conduct memorialized in writing, when we've got admissions or at least concessions by defense counsel about how the accused hit on many women, gave a massage to a subordinate for 30 to 40 minutes, and so forth, why wouldn't that, standing alone, say that the government has a very strong case here?
Two answers, Your Honor. First of all, the judge did not properly instruct even on a general intent offense. She basically told the members, if you find that he did the acts and you find that they're unbecoming, he's guilty. And that's not proper. But secondly, the Fletcher factors are to be balanced with each other. So even if the evidence was extremely strong, which we don't concede that it is, but even if it were, the first two factors are so off the chart that they vastly outweigh the third prong, which is weight of the evidence. And that's why this court can find plain error, error that's plain and obvious that was prejudicial. And don't forget, he spent 2 years in confinement for the sexual offense, you know, that was reversed. And then on rehearing, he didn't even get any confinement. So he's been punished. There's been plenty of prejudice. His right to a fair trial was prejudiced. And I see my light is on.
Chief Judge, can we ask about the waiver issue?
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Could you address the Chief Judge's waiver issue?
Yes.
My apologies, Chief Judge. It's waived because it wasn't objected to timely, but the court under Humphreys will still review for plain error. So, unfortunately, all three of these issues that court granted on are reviewed for plain error. And we believe that we've met that burden to show. Thank you, Your Honor.
Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. Court is in recess, pending further order of the